All right, and I am joined tonight with Joshua Cutchin and Red Pill Junkie.
Good evening.
How are you guys?
Doing well.
Yeah, I'm delighted to join you guys because right now with my current day job, I'm being a bit absent from the 4chan world. So now with you, I will get my 4chan fix of the week.
We're going to deal tonight with, this piece that P.Z. Myers wrote about the Paradigm Symposium. And the Paradigm Symposium, I think this was the last one. Am I wrong on that?
Well, I mean,
I think Scotty announced that was it.
That has he officially?
I think so. I think I saw it printed somewhere that he said he wasn't going to. This was going to be the last one.
Okay.
I wasn't aware of that, but that sort of jives with what I know. So and that makes sense.
I mean, if he has already officially announced that, then yeah, I was aware that he wasn't interested in pursuing, you know, continuing with the Paradigm event any further because it's a really, really hard work, you know, organizing an event of that magnitude, especially if, like, you are, like, I want to say a one-man show because he obviously had more collaborators, especially at the beginning of the event with when Micah was still involved. And of course, he has
John Ford.
John and his lovely wife, Rainey, who was also really, really hardworking when it came to try to tackle the innumerable logistics. And, well, part of me is incredibly sad because, to be honest, I wouldn't be speaking with you guys right now at this very moment if it hasn't been for that first Paradigm Symposium. It kind of was like a turning point in my life when I decided to, yeah, that I did want to become more involved in this field, you know, and Scotty and Micah and Rainey and, well, and John, too. They gave me the chance. They gave me the first avenue to do so.
Well, that's awesome. And I've had Scotty on here the last 2 years. They've been doing it to promote it and tell everyone about it. And he was on back. This was originally going to be last October, and I think he was on in September maybe or August talking about it. And then it got moved to May.
Yes.
And I think they had some money issues and some people had dropped out, and it was a much smaller list of guests for this when it actually happened here in May. I noticed the speakers had gone down considerably. I mean, not that it was a bad list of people talking. It's just that a bunch of people had been removed, and I'm assuming, you know, you probably had scheduling conflicts, and if they were having some problems with people dropping out, they probably couldn't afford to pay everyone.
Right, and when these things go smoothly, they're still difficult to put on. So
yeah. So, but anyway, P.Z. Myers wrote this nice little hit piece, mostly focusing on Laird Scranton and Peter Robbins, two of the nicest people I've met in this field. Not that I've met anyone who really hasn't been nice, but the two of them really stand out as genuinely nice individuals. And he took it upon himself to just rip them apart in a very ignorant way in his column.
Yeah, I actually wasn't aware that it was Peasy's column when I was reading it. And as I got further down the column and I finally saw his name, I was like, oh, well, this all makes sense now.
And P.Z. Myers considers himself a skeptic, but I wouldn't call him a skeptic. I'd call him, well, let's be nice. Let's call him a debunker.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice way to put it.
Well, he is definitely part of this group or subgroup of skepticism that is also very much involved in what we could say the new atheist activism that became prevalent at the beginning of this new millennium, you know, after 9/11 and all that, you know, so with Richard Dawkins and all these very notorious atheists, I think P.C. Myers became involved with that. I feel that at some point he kind of like started to distance himself from that group, and I really thought that at some point he started to, well, I don't want to say mellow, but I think he started to become far more neutral, I think, far more, more akin to my sense of skepticism as of late. But now with this new article, I guess he returned to his old vitriolic, if we can say that, tone.
Well, the thing that kept on running through my mind when I was reading this is that I am a big fan of cinema, and I acknowledge when things go wrong, and I have a lot of things I have a lot of critical things to say of a lot of films these days. But it's so easy to sit back after the film has been made and say, well, you know, if you just done this, it would have been a lot better, or you just done that, it would have been a lot better.
Oh, sure.
And it's so easy for somebody sitting in an audience, even if everybody's at their A game and is doing great research, to sit back and say, oh, well, you know what, this is a hole in this, or this, it's a lot easier to tear down than it is to create. And that's sort of one of the through lines that really sort of jumped out at me in this particular article.
And when he takes on Laird Scranton, he clearly does not know anything about Laird Scranton. I mean, it seems like he does, but he's just choosing to ignore the depth of Laird's work.
Well,
go on.
Let's be honest here. I mean, any attendee to these kinds of events doesn't necessarily have the obligation to know or be particularly well versed in the work of every single speaker. I mean that's the whole point of attending these kind of things, right? To learn new things.
Right, but I mean, there's no barrier for entry to me to attend a kinesiology conference, but I wouldn't know half the stuff that they're talking about either.
Nor would you be in any position to write an article criticizing it.
Right. And when somebody who is attending this conference doesn't know about the Rendlesham incident, I have to say, you know, that's sort of on you in a lot of ways. I understand that you want to sort of meet somebody halfway, but when you have a case that's that famous and has been gone over with a fine-tooth comb like Rendlesham, it would take the entire length of your speech just to give everybody a primer.
I will have to take the devil's advocate position in this one, guys, because, obviously, Rendlesham is, in the UFO field, is one of the biggest and most popular cases to date. But let's be honest here. Outside of our little niche, if I go to the average man on the street and I tell him, hey, what do you think about Rendlesham? He'll say, huh? It's not the same as, hey, what do you think about Roswell? Roswell has managed to really penetrate the popular culture in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, thanks in part by things like, I don't know, the first Independence Day movie and things, the X-Files and all of that. So
sure.
It's pretty, it's a good bet that if you stop someone, a complete stranger, and you say Roswell, they will probably have a bit of an understanding that that has to do with this alleged alien craft crash in New Mexico, but not the same with Rendlesham. So in that regard, when I read what BC wrote about Peter Robbins' presentation, I was trying to say, well, obviously, this is someone who had an agenda, you know, it's clearly a hit piece, but at the same time, I would really be interested in finding the opinion of someone who was, a bit more open-minded than him, but also maybe not as well-versed in the case, and trying to see how they would react to the information that Peter provided during that presentation.
But also consider that the average person on the street who doesn't know anything about this also wouldn't be at Paradigm, A, and B, wouldn't be writing a piece about it.
Well, then that's kind of like a conundrum, because
I think if PZ was going to write a piece about it, he should be a little
obviously
informed about the people he's writing about, is what I'm saying.
Mm.
Yeah, and again, like what this sort of reminds me of is I read an article the other day, Captain America Civil War is out in theaters, and somebody was saying it doesn't function as a movie on its own. It doesn't, you know, a lot of the characters don't have arcs, and I get that. Yes, I get that. And I can understand that. But it's not meant to. you're meant to come into there with some level of knowledge of what's going on and some level of familiarity with the characters and the context.
Right.
And it's almost like saying, you know, well, this, you know, I'm a classical musician. This etude book isn't written for beginners. Well, no, it's not written for beginners. Congratulations. You're supposed to do some work and some prep work to be able to access this particular piece of content.
You know what, guys? I mean, let's talk about if we're going to compare Paradigm Symposium with Captain America Civil War. what I feel it's at the crux of this argument is that if you're going to pay a ticket to see the movie Captain America Civil War, it's because you want to see the movie. And I think in the case with PC, he really didn't want to attend Paradigm Symposium. He only went there because he wanted to find material in order to lambast and criticize and belittle both the attendees and the speakers. But he really wasn't willing to give these guys, the presenters, the speakers, the benefit of the doubt from the beginning. It's really clear in his writing.
Yeah, he also attacks two people who are actually very grounded in the stuff they're researching and the way they present their research. And I'm sure in however long the talk is, they cannot even come close to the amount of information they can put into a book, first of all. But I mean, Laird, he's saying basically Laird is like just taking one word in a language and comparing it to a different word that means something else in another language, and that's not what he's doing. Laird is taking, you know, like the Dogon language and comparing it to Egyptian and saying, okay, so this is the word in Egyptian, here's the word in Dogon. Not only do they mean the same thing, but all these words have second meanings, which are also the same. So what are the chances that they've come from a different source when you have two totally different meanings to a single word that are the same in two different languages?
Right, and I would add that it's quite difficult to build a thoroughly backed up, thoroughly reinforced case in a presentation. I mean, yes, presentations should be a gateway for people to understand your research, but at the same time, it's not at all like, you know, it's not at all as thorough as your actual book or your actual, you know, research is when presented in full.
And you guys, you know, the saddest thing about all of this, for me personally, is the fact that the way I regarded the Paradigm Symposium is that it was one of the few events out there that was trying to build bridges between these two camps that have always been at odds between each other, you know, the skeptics and the so-called true believers. I remember my first conversations with John Ward, who was a speaker in the first Paradigm Symposium, and then he became Scotty's partner, you know, and he became much more involved in the organizing of the subsequent Paradigm Symposium. And because John is he's an archaeologist, he's been working for years at the site Gebel al Sisila with his wife Maria, I remember discussing the classical things about Egypt with John, you know, like, oh my God, the age of the Sphinx, you know, the size of the Great Pyramid, and of course the idea of whether it could have been possible for people in the ancient past with, you know, with primitive techniques to build such an incredible monument of that level of magnitude, right? And it was really startling for me to realize that John was very, very skeptical of all these very popular New Age ideas about the Great Pyramid, to the point that in the first Paradigm Symposium, the meme levitation, you know, became our inside joke you know, whenever we were referring to John Ward, because it was something that really bothered him, you know, this idea that, oh, well, the ancients levitated, you know, all the stone blocks using like magic or using like acoustic techniques or using the technology of the ancient aliens, you know, in order to build the pyramid, you know. It was something that really bothered him because, as an archaeologist, someone who was working at this site, Gebel Sesila, which is actually the quarry, when a great amount of all the stone blocks that were used for building many of the monuments in ancient Egypt, that's where the Egyptians quarried the stone and then, you know, moved it through these great barges or boats on the Nile River. That's the way they that's the place where they quarried the rock. So he was incredibly ground to earth with regards to those things. Although he was also very, very open-minded and very esoteric in other aspects of what is like what we could call the Egyptian mysteries. You know, I remember how John kept blowing my mind every time I talked to him about personal anecdotes that happened to him when he was inside the Great Pyramid, the things that he experienced there and in other places. And I really felt that, okay, so Paradigm seems to be the ideal place in which people with different levels of skepticism and different levels of belief of alternative ideas can mingle and they can exchange their point of views in a very civil and in a very safe environment. And I was hoping for that Paradigm could still manage to do that and foster such kind of dialogue in other forums or in other events. And, well, the problem is that obviously it's inevitable that people like PC Myers, someone who is really entrenched in one side of the conversation, will go to such events and they will completely, you know, I don't want to say this figure, but they will completely misrepresent what the event is all about.
Let's actually, one of the things I wanted to bring into this, since you mentioned the moving blocks for the pyramids and stuff, are some of the explanations that pop up regarding these type of things. There was an article I saw just the other day about how the students moved a 1-ton block 10 feet using wooden rollers, and thus proving that that's how they moved the stones for Stonehenge.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I hear something like this, I think, okay, why don't you use the, let's see, I think they're 30-ton blocks in Stonehenge. So why don't you get a 30-ton block and see how easy it is to move it on your wooden rollers?
Exactly.
You know, it's like you get people who say, well, we could build the Great Pyramid. I built this, you know, 1/100th version, you know, model version of it. It's 6 feet tall. And it's like, okay, great. You realize how heavy some of the blocks in the Great Pyramid are, right?
Yeah, and it's not only the thing about lifting 30-ton, 20-ton, 50-ton stone block. It's about trying to position it in such a precise manner as to not completely disrupt, you know, the whole plan.
Exactly.
Of the, you know, architectural monument. You know, I mean, the level of precision in which these blocks were placed, that is the thing that boggles the mind. And there's still people who are trying to come up with new ideas. I mean, a friend of mine, Efrain Palermo, I don't know if you have had him on your shows,
no.
Right? Well, maybe you should. I mean, Efrain is a fascinating person. He's He is something of an amateur astronomer. He's actually the guy who first proposed the idea that all those like weird dark stains on the Martian photographs were actually the result of water. Back in the time when, you know, NASA still thought of Mars as a completely dry world. So, you know, well, obviously Mars is one of Ephraim's passions, but he wrote me an email about this new idea he had for, you know, maybe an alternative to how the Egyptians moved the stone blocks. And I don't want to give that idea away because he's still trying to develop it. I think I recommended to him that he should get in contact with John Anthony West. That maybe John will be able to, you know, provide some advice, or maybe to, you know, to say whether he's on a good lead, or maybe, you know, the idea is not worth pursuing. But
Right. Anyway,
you know, that's the beauty of Egypt. You know, it fosters the imagination.
And a couple of years ago, I think it's been a couple of years now, I had Stephen Myers on, and Stephen Myers has a great theory on how they built the pyramids using locks,
yes,
and boats and moving it up the pyramid. Now the problem, of course, is you can't prove it. Will it work? Well, it looks like it would actually work. It doesn't mean that that's how they did it.
Right.
And this is one of the things people don't always grasp. You get, you know, it's like, it, well, I mean, an example I've used before, it's James Randi showing you that with sleight of hand, he can reproduce the stuff that, what's his name?
Uri Geller
did. And it's like, okay, well, you've now opened up a possibility of what he might be doing, but you've far from proved, just because it can be done that way, that's how it was done. You know, just because you can move a one-ton block on wooden rollers, that doesn't mean that the ancients moved a 20 or 30 ton block on wooden rollers.
Well, and this is the problem that we run into a lot of times with archaeology, is that there's this blending of the line between probability and impossibility, you know.
Yeah.
It could have been rollers, and that could have been a multi-generational process. But if it's, again, it's this contradictory thing, if it's a multi-generational process, then why is it just a tomb? You know, it seems like there would be some sort of greater function. You know, you'd think that a tomb would be completed during someone's lifetime, not like a 90, 100, 120-year project or whatever.
Not only that, but we know the great – according to the Egyptian records, one of the only things they said is, I think it was built in 25 years. And Egyptologists have said something like a new stone would have to be put in place every, like, 6 seconds or something like that to be the case.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's essentially, that's just not possible. Even with high technology, that wouldn't necessarily be possible.
Yep.
So something's not right there.
Yeah, I can't get through an hour and 20-minute movie on Netflix without pausing it 7 times, you know?
So. Yeah, what about bathroom breaks, you know? Where can we find the Egyptian adult diaper that all the construction workers use?
There was a blog entry I wrote back in 2013. There was a show called Digging for the Truth. I think it was on the History Channel. And they did a show on Olmecs. And I said, oh, okay, cool, Olmecs. And the amount of nonsense that they threw into this show, like they'd ask an archaeologist, a question. The archaeologist would be like, you know, we really don't know much about the Olmecs. We don't know how they built their heads. We don't know how they moved them. And the whole show basically came down to them taking, I think the heads were something like 10 tons or something like that. So they took a half a ton, a 500-pound block, and they moved it from where they know they quarried the heads to one of the areas with the heads, and went, okay, so now we've proved how the Olmecs moved their heads. And it's like, okay, clearly your idea of proof and the actual concept of proof are two totally different things, because all they proved is a 500-pound block could be moved the way they showed it was moved, and they had a hard time with it.
Yeah.
Now multiply that to 20 tons. Yeah, it looks like they were 20 tons, some of the Olmec heads. And it's going to be not such an easy task. And like I said, they didn't have an easy task to begin with. And it was, you know, such a small fraction of the size of these heads. But when they got done, they basically said, well, we've proved how the Olmecs moved their heads, and it didn't take anything, you know, really special. And it's like, you didn't prove anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish that, you know, if I were involved with some university or something, I would wish to send students of design or architecture to places like ancient Egypt and all that, in order to arrange some kind of workshop. You know, people with a very creative, you know, right side kind of thinking, go and, you know, tackle all these mysteries and maybe, you know, come up with new ideas. And that, like you said, doesn't mean that they will come up with the actual answer to how the Egyptians performed this task of moving the blocks and placing it in order to build the pyramid, but, you know, at least to showing how there could be many ways in which they could have been solved, you know?
Right. And like I said, Stephen Myers had a great concept. It doesn't mean that's how they did it. And unless we found remnants of these pulleys and canal systems that he speculates they used, it's still just another idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to be fair, well, that kind of like close-mindedness that people in the archaeology department, in Egyptology, that is also found in people on the other side of the spectrum, you know, the ancient aliens proponents, you know, to the idea of, oh, I don't know, therefore aliens, you know. It's a meme because it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, these people say, well, clearly the only solution is that some, like, advanced version of us came a long time ago in some kind of, like, ancient version of a rocket, you know, and they landed here physically and they interacted with these people and they kind of taught them what they knew and they left, you know, and say, well, okay, so that is your solution, but as a designer, you know, we're talking about many ways in which we could try to solve this mystery. There's plenty of other alternative theories to which in which we could explain this alleged, disparaged, you know, noble knowledge that these ancient cultures had possessed, you know, the breakaway civilization, or maybe, you know, interaction with non-human entities through the use of entheogens, you know, dreaming. I don't know. There's plenty of other ways that we could try to solve it instead of like, oh yeah, ancient aliens, or, you know, it's all, you know, it's all bogus, it's all hoaxes, this, the way that, you know, people like PC Myers, you know, lean to.
And like I said, the problem is that a lot of these people, like, if they can come up with a way it could be done, well, that's how it was done.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that it's totally plausible. Yes, you've come up with a plausible way this could have been done. That doesn't mean that's how it was done. And you have to find evidence to prove that's how it was done before you can say, hey, this is how it was done.
Yeah, I always defer to the idea that things that we speculate about are probably, especially in the ancient past, are probably weirder and more inventive than we think that they are. Because you got to remember, one thing has not changed. Human beings are lazy, and they want to do things in the most efficient way possible. So if it means putting giant blocks on logs and rolling them hundreds of miles or whatever the case may be, It just doesn't jive with what I know about human behavior.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's interesting to consider is that maybe to them it was, you know, almost something of a given. You know, the idea of moving stone blocks so heavy with such ease that it wasn't even worthy of explaining, you know, to the, to your descendants how you did it. It's like, you know, trying to explain your, you know, your future descendants how we will, you, how we managed to, like, I don't know, send emails, you know, drive a car, you know. It's, you assume that everyone understands how you do that.
Or it's sacred knowledge and it fails to get passed down for one reason or
another. That's true. Maybe that's a secret.
And I don't know who said it. I want to say it was Graham Hancock who said it, but maybe not. But they said something to the effect of, if they're using these large blocks, why would they use them if they were going to be so difficult to move? And the answer is, and kind of like what Josh is saying, that, you know, mankind's generally pretty lazy. We're not going to go do something the hard way when there's easier. If we can make smaller blocks and move them easier, why wouldn't we do that? So the answer might be that they didn't have a hard time moving these blocks. They had something that would enable them to easily move these big blocks, and it wasn't a massive undertaking for them.
I remember that John Anthony West on the Third Paradigm Symposium posed that very question during his presentation, but the answer he provided is they did that. They moved, they built these ancient monuments using these incredibly large stone blocks because they had to. Because in his opinion, it was something of a fundamental ingredient in order to achieve the effect or the function that these monuments were supposed to provide. And in his case, he said that, you know, some kind of like change in the consciousness or the perception of the people inside these monuments can only be achieved when you use such large stone blocks.
Right. And again, totally possible.
Yeah.
And I think either one of those could be true. Maybe they had an easier way to move them, or maybe they just needed those blocks. I mean, but you look at like Baalbek and stuff too, and those blocks are even bigger.
Yeah.
And that wasn't necessarily a consciousness-changing machine.
That we know of.
That we know of, that's true. And we see these giant blocks all over the world.
Yes.
And it's not like it's just Egypt or something in the Mediterranean area that they were moving enormous blocks. There are sites in Russia, South America, obviously, where you are in Central America, Red Pill. There's all these temples that are built with large blocks.
I'm actually in North America, but yeah, I get you.
Yeah, you are North America, aren't you? I think of Mexico as Central America.
Yeah, most Americans do.
The map is not the territory.
Fine, you can be North America too.
Oh, thank you.
But, yeah, I mean, like you see it everywhere. You see it in Easter Island, you know, totally disconnected from everyone else. They have these giant heads.
Yep.
So, again, you got to wonder, did they have an easier way of moving them? That, you know, something that was passed down from an earlier generation and got lost over time.
Yeah, but I don't think that the answer, because it's tragic that the answer has become, let's invoke aliens. You know, let's invoke an outside source. I feel like it's so much easier to just say there was some sort of civilization that had some sort of abilities that we aren't quite aware of. And I think that that's such a more parsimonious answer than invoking some sort of deified aliens for coming down from the stars.
If we had evidence, A, that aliens existed, and B, that they'd been here, then maybe we could say with some you know, real weight behind it, well, aliens did it. But the fact that we have yet to prove aliens even exist, you know, plenty of people may believe that, and I would say in the grand scheme of things, it's likely that there's life out in space. But then you have to be able to say with any amount of certainty that they were here. And what we have from the ancient aliens lobby is kind of a, well, this sort of looks like it could be aliens, but it could be other stuff too. So it's not really, you know, a home run there.
Yeah, right. And again, I must emphasize how, I mean, maybe we shouldn't try to pursue the easiest explanation. What I mean is, like, let's say, let's take, for example, Michelangelo. You know, he used to sculpt in marble. And marble is actually one of the toughest materials in which you can create things. You know, it would have been far easier for him to sculpt the David, his David, using clay. But he chose marble for a reason, because, you know, marble is a far more precious material, because it's far more sturdy, it's timeless. It's almost like it gives the sculpture almost like a sacredness to it. you know, and there comes a time when, you know, the stone block has imperfections, and, you know, at there was times in his career when the marble block had such imperfection that he just gave up and he didn't finish the sculpture. But that was kind of like the risk of it. So my point is that, okay, maybe it was easy for the ancients to move the stone blocks, or maybe it wasn't. We don't really know. What we do know is that these stone blocks are probably going to stand there far longer than our modern and, you know, frail, flimsy constructions, you know. I mean, Baalbek is going to be there, you know, far longer than, you know, the Empire State Building.
Yes, that is very true. Made me think of something, and I've completely forgotten what it was.
Sorry.
It's all your fault, Josh.
I have a tendency to do that. No, but it's again, like, one of the things that I find even more miraculous than the pyramids in a lot of ways are the Egyptian busts and whatnot that are made out of dolerite, which I believe that's the mineral, which is so harder than steel.
Diorite.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Sorry.
One or the other, whatever it is, it's actually harder than steel and shows no tool marks. And I just got done reading, just finished reading Gordon White's Starships, and he addresses this in the book himself. And, you know, as opposed to invoking ancient aliens, what if there was some sort of, you know, what he talks about is, like, you know, Western society nowadays has become masters of metal. We can do all sorts of interesting things with metal. We can meld metal into any sort of shape.
Can even listen to metal.
Yeah, exactly. What if ancient civilizations treated stone as we do metal, and they had put all their effort into figuring out what you can do with stone, and could even maybe, you know, in some sense concretize, pour all sorts of minerals that we have just lost that particular technology? It seems like a very simple fix to a lot of these questions, that you can actually, you know, let's say there are these great slabs of rock. What if they were poured rather than carved with a method that we don't know about?
It could be, but at the same time, building things with metal nowadays is it's a very fast construction method. But, you know, maybe back in the day, it didn't matter if it took one single sculpture his entire lifetime, you know, to sculpt one single diorite, you know, piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, so we are accustomed to think of problems in terms of efficiency, in terms of, you know, saving time. Maybe that wasn't the case in the ancient times. You know, we know that there are artisans and there are artists who take years in order to complete a single piece. You know, Michelangelo, I mean, I mentioned him earlier. How many years was he there, you know, painting the Sistine Chapel? You know, nowadays we will find ways to try to optimize, you know, him and try to finish that as soon as possible. But
I was going to say that's a very good point, because nowadays we're so distracted. I can only imagine being in something like ancient Egypt, and this is your thing. This is your life thing. Like, you wake up and you do this. Yeah. You know, there's no TV shows to catch. There's no
podcasts to listen to.
Yeah. No insurance to pay. You just, you know, work on carving. So yeah, that totally makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about ancient aliens, we go back to the PZ Myers article, and when he's ripping on Laird, he starts talking about him, you know, I believe he said he was, you know, compared him to like an ancient alien theorist or something to the effect. I don't see where it is on here. But the thing is, you know, first of all, he says the work on the Dogon tribe has been, let's see if I can find the article here, the actual thing he said. I don't want to misquote his nonsense.
Well, he cast the whole thing into a negative light to begin with, talking about the pseudo archaeology of the Dogon people. And look, there've been a lot of shenanigans around stuff like this. We realize that no one in this field is above reproach.
Yeah.
But we ask that you treat us as even handedly as you would anybody else.
Well, he says they have a myth about being visited by frog people from Sirius and have advanced astronomical knowledge, although it seems their knowledge was actually cobbled up by unscrupulous Western con artists and their cultures being co-opted to prop up pseudo-historical bull by a swarm of ancient aliens weirdos. So first of all, that's just derogatory for the sake of being derogatory.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously if you believe in ancient aliens, you're a weirdo.
Yeah.
Second, I don't think that they believe in frog people from Sirius. The way Laird actually explained it was that whatever they were communicating with were from another dimension, from the way the Dogon were describing it, but that they had some connection to the star Sirius.
Well, and the Nomo are better described as fish people, from what I recall.
Yes,
frog people. So, I mean, like, again, if you're getting these sort of details wrong, what makes you an authority to criticize this?
And their knowledge was actually cobbled up by unscrupulous Western con artists, which I'm assuming is relating to the people who initially went down and studied the Dogon for ages and got into their inner circle and collected all of this sacred knowledge. And then when another group went down, you know, to verify it, they didn't put in the work. They didn't get into their inner circles there. And they were basically told, well, we don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because they weren't privy, they didn't earn the trust of the Dogon when they went back down there, and they then claimed, well, all their work is nonsense. They just made it up because we went down there and they didn't tell us any of this stuff.
Well, and the thing that is conspicuously left out for me that I find even more interesting than the Star Lore is that the Dogon told them about the basic structure. Sorry, the Nomo told the Dogon about the basic structure of cells as well.
Yes.
Which doesn't get as much press as everything else does. but I find actually even more compelling in a way.
If you read Laird's books, they're not the most exciting books in the world. You know, they're a little bit, you know, dry because he's literally showing you each step of the way where these things compare. I mean, it's very detailed. He's not just making assumptions. And when I went to see him and John Anthony West, sitting there and talking to him, he doesn't want to put anything on paper that he doesn't have like two ways to compare and confirm before he wants to put it out there, because he wants to know that what he's putting out there is real and it's not just wishful thinking.
Yep. Yeah, that is the way his mind works. I mean, I believe that Laird works with computers. You know, that's his like day job. So that shows that he's very methodical in his thinking. He's not really extrapolating or jumping, you know, from point A to point D, the way that BC, you know, portrayed, you know, on his blog.
And to be fair, though, trying to sum all that up in a talk,
of course, yeah,
may make it seem like he jumped from A to D without anything in between.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you would think if you're going to Paradigm, you should at least be familiar with some of the guests.
Or. You go to Paradigm and you feel, well, this guy is clearly, you know, full of crap. I don't believe anything he says. Well, maybe, you know, go to him at the end of the day, you know, at the bar and confront him and, you know, and start a dialogue. You know, that is also permitted during the Paradigm Symposium.
And he says near the end, I know I said I was going to listen to the notorious Travis Walton, too, but at that point I'd seen enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like notorious. I don't think I've ever heard anyone label Travis Walton as notorious.
I think there are a lot of abductees who are a lot shadier than Travis Walton, and that's where I'll leave that.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, Travis seems like a very genuine guy. There's no holes in their story. There's nothing that you know, whatever happened sounds like it actually happened, whatever it may end up being. I mean, he obviously has his beliefs of what it was, and it's totally understandable.
Sure.
But whatever it may be, whether he's right or not, I believe it actually happened.
Yeah. Whether he perceived it correctly or not, you know, I mean, after all the things that transpired when he wasn't able to be located by all the people looking for him, you know, when they believed that he had actually been murdered by his logging partners.
And there was the one guy in the Travis documentary, they're talking about this. Was it Philip Klass who was going after them? I think so.
Yes. Yeah, he offered the guy money.
to say that it didn't happen. And it's like, okay, so not to tell the truth, but to actually just fit your version of events. And he turned it down, and the guy needed the money.
Yeah.
So at that point, that really says something.
Yeah, the one of my regrets of not attending Paradigm Symposium this year is because I really wanted to have a chance to interact with Travis Walton. Hopefully I'll have my chance some other time.
I would hope so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're down close to you when they're in Arizona doing their thing there, that where they go back to where it all happened.
Yeah.
He also attacks Scott Walter at the end of this, just kind of out of the blue. So today I think I'll go listen to Scott Walter, the archaeological fraud behind America on Earth.
Well, to be honest, I don't agree with some of the things that Scott Walter, you know, claims. But that's...
Oh, no, neither do I, but I wouldn't call him a fraud.
Yeah, it's a thing that BC didn't get. I mean, he portrayed the attendees as, like, eating everything that the presenters were throwing at them, you know, and asking for a second helping. And that's not the case at all. I remember all the discussions that transpired, you know, during the first three paradigms, you know, when everybody was at the bar. And just because you go to this event doesn't mean that you happen to believe wholeheartedly, you know, to everything that you listen to. You know, I mean, people have their own particular level of skepticism, you know, even if they agree, believe some things that are, you know, that you don't happen to agree with, and they will refuse to believe in some other things. It's like skeptics always believe that if you believe in UFOs, then you, by de facto, you also believe in Bigfoot. And right. We all know that's, you know, couldn't be farther from the truth, you know. People who are interested in cryptozoology often believe that people who are interested in ufology are all nutjobs.
Exactly. And I don't really understand that. Like, the way people will draw lines around this stuff, it's like, oh, no, UFOs make total sense, but Bigfoot or ghosts? No, that's nonsense. And it's like, why would you think one is more valid than the other, really? I mean, these are all things people experience, and...
Sorry, go ahead.
Go on. No, go on.
I was just going to say, I was listening to a Bigfoot-centric podcast, and they were talking about, obviously, they were talking about Bigfoot on the Bigfoot-centric podcast, but one of the guys being interviewed said, you know, I don't think much about UFOs, but, you know, you got to hand it to the UFO guys. If what they say is true, then maybe Bigfoot is what humans would have been without alien intervention. And I'm like, wait. I know tons of UFO people who would have a huge issue with what you just said. You can be interested in a particular subject and not be interested or believe, quote unquote, or ascribe to all the things in that subject. Like, I am up to my elbows in UFOs, guys, but I have no time for Zachariah Sitchin. I have little time for ancient alien stuff. I have little time for the disclosure movement. It's not like this all or nothing thing. And I feel like people think that, oh, well, you believe in UFOs, so you think about ancient aliens, that's true, and the government knows about UFOs, and, you know, just no. You're allowed to do the cafeteria style of belief here. You can take a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and no thanks, I won't have any sweet potatoes today. You know?
And that's true. Because if you don't research the subject, you know, like most people will say, well, if you believe in UFOs, you believe in extraterrestrials from other planets, because that's all they know about UFOs.
Yep.
And so if someone's really into cryptozoology and they've never looked at UFOs, they think, okay, well, I don't believe in extraterrestrials. But what if that's not what UFOs are, you know? And I guess in a way that makes sense. Like, the UFO people think that the Bigfoot people are all flesh and blood Bigfoots, and they go, well, that's ridiculous. You couldn't have a flesh and blood Bigfoot in this world. It would have been discovered. But they don't realize that there's plenty of people who have a more paranormal explanation that may bleed over to the UFO explanation.
Yep.
I mean, maybe it doesn't, but I think there's probably a connection between all this. I also just noticed that on PZ Meyer's blog, he has a new entry that says Laird Scranton wants to have a conversation. And he says he has made an appearance in my thread ridiculing his superficial approach to history, and has invited me to join him on his Facebook discussion of the same. Unfortunately, he's picked the worst time. I'm in Minneapolis and be flying off to Korea in the morning. So far, he hasn't managed to justify building elaborate and bizarre histories based on the similar sounds of words in Egypt, Egyptian Dogon, and Pharosi. I think it's Pharosi. So I don't see much of a point anyway.
Well, and if I want to get really snarky and engage in the sort of thing that PZ engages in, I would say that he is someone who is a professor at the University of Minnesota Morris. Now, no ill intent to anyone who's graduated from UM Morris, but on the other hand, you have Jeffrey Kripal, who is a professor at Rice. So,
yeah.
You know, it's... I worked in academia for a while, so I'm going to engage in that little bit of flagship university snark, and I'll retire there.
The thing is, like, the stuff PZ Myers writes comes across simply as childish.
Yeah, he does end up being really immature in the way he blogs, and I, you know, I'm going to tackle something that happened some years ago when he sent his minions to attack the Daily Grail because Greg Taylor had posted some poll. I don't even remember the subject of the poll. I guess it was about trying to figure out the opinion of our members with regards to UFOs, like, say, you know, are UFOs like extraterrestrial craft, interdimensional time travelers, all of the above, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
There was a time when PZ loved to go and send all his fans to wreck those kinds of online polls in order to try to make some kind of childish point. And so he did so with our poll on the Daily Grail. And then a few of his members, you know, tried to stay there and start to troll our site. To be fair, there were one or two who were trying to engage in a meaningful, intelligent dialogue, conversation with us, you know, people like myself and other members. And, you know, for a time we did manage to have a really interesting conversation on our comment threads. But those were truly the exceptions to the rule. Most of the people who followed PC's command to go and wrecked the online poll of the woo-woos, you know, being, you know, people in the Daily Grail, were there so full of themselves and so certain that they were right and we were wrong, that it was, you know, there was really no point in trying to ask them to stay and engage in a dialogue the same way that Laird here is trying to do the same with PC.
Yeah, and I think Laird took it very personally and wanted and figured that it was just that PZ didn't understand his work, when it looks like PZ has no desire to understand his work.
Sure.
So, but yeah, the It's just, I don't understand. I guess I do understand. It's human nature to always need to be right.
Of course.
And if we could get over that, I mean, there's so much interesting stuff out there. We could get so much further that instead of just trying to force our ideas down and our viewpoints on other people, if we just looked at them.
Imagine a debate between someone like B.C. Myers and someone like Robert Anton Wilson. Now that was something I would have paid hard cash to witness.
I don't know if PZ would have done it.
No, but it would have been enjoyable nonetheless, you know, to say, see how he would have tried to wiggle himself out of the situation.
And we did do a show a while ago on character assassination. I ended up pulling it almost as soon as I put it up because I had actually gotten a few things, big things, wrong because I didn't take notes, and that's what happens when I don't take notes.
Yeah.
Or, you know, my brain malfunctions when I say things like red pill junkie is in Central America.
Shame on you, sir.
It's on the record. It's on the record.
Well, damn it, you're closer to Central America than we are.
Now I'm going to have to write a hit piece against Where Did the Road Go? He's ignoring most hosts who doesn't
the
know
road
a thing about geography.
Central America.
Yeah.
Well, Mexico's to the north, right? Up above Canada?
Yeah, more or less.
But one of the things we had dealt with was some of the attacks that people like both Brian Forrester and David Politis have come under.
Yeah.
And back when I was, I think the second time I had Brian Forrester on, I had posted in some group, some archaeological group, that I was having him on because they had posted something about his work on the skulls, the Paracas skulls, and getting the DNA stuff done. And the article on it was really just attacking Brian. You know, oh, he's not an archaeologist. He's not this. And I'm thinking, yeah, right, because he's sending it to, you know, someone to do the DNA studies. He's not doing the DNA studies. And I'm thinking, I don't really see what the issue is here without, you know, and I kind of naively went into it thinking, well, you know, why should this be a problem? Not realizing that these people just didn't like Brian, you know, and they were going out of their way to attack him. And when I tried to say something like, well, you know, I'm going to have him on. And then they were like, well, why would you have him on to spill his nonsense and et cetera, et cetera. And at some point they said, well, you should have someone from our group on and, you know, tell the other side of the story. And because I didn't respond within like 10 minutes, they kicked me out of the group. And I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm not going to respond to that.
Yeah, it's a problem. I mean, how can't we, you know, try to find some kind of neutral positions? Right, we don't know, you don't know. Let's try to find the answers together.
And I mean, but it was very obvious that it was a personal thing against Brian.
Yeah,
I mean, I think even if you don't agree with somebody, it's worth listening. Most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes you know right off you're going, okay, this guy's off the deep end. I don't really think I can use this. But even then, sometimes they'll say something and you'll go, huh, I didn't know that. Or that was kind of interesting. And David Politis, the same thing. The most criticisms you get against David are people attacking him personally. Right. And it's, you know, they'll say things like, well, he said he, you know, was 20 years a cop, but he was only 16.5. And it turns out, no, he was a cop for 20 years. He was in, I believe, San Francisco for 3.5 years and then 16 and a half in San Jose, which I believe makes 20.
Yep.
It's
almost like a rule of thumb. The more ad hominem people get, the less credible their particular side of the argument is. No, I'm reminded of that whole Zai Huas, Graham Hancock thing.
Oh, yeah.
What was that, 2 years ago?
Something like that, yeah. No, it was only about a year ago because it happened right before I went to see John Anthony West in Laird Scranton, and that was about a year ago.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, and again, like the less secure someone is with their own individual argument, the more that they're going to start breaking out personal attacks, you know?
Yeah, and when it's all personal attacks, I mean, anyone's research is going to have holes. No one's perfect. You know, someone actually who wasn't criticizing David personally had said that one of the cases in his book, someone came out and admitted to murdering the person. Okay, well, that's fine. I mean, there's going to be cases in his books that are like that.
Sure.
I mean, some of them are going to have very prosaic explanations. I mean, he's looking for a pattern. And, of course, people are saying, well, he's cherry picking. And our other co-host who's not with us tonight, Mike, will say that. But at the same time, when you're looking for a pattern, isn't that what you're going to do? I mean, Josh, if you're looking for food-based UFO encounters, you're technically cherry picking the ones that involve food.
Yep. I mean, there's kind of no other way unless you're taking the whole of human experience.
Exactly. But, when you see these constant personal attacks and it's just kind of like, you know, and really digging to kind of come up with dirt on somebody and there's not a whole lot there. So you amplify what you find and it's like, this isn't helping anyone. What is your problem with this person that, you know, like Brian Forrester? I mean, these skulls are interesting. And the DNA research that he got done came back with some interesting results. And in doing all this, he's actually leaned away from the ancient alien idea that he once was on top of.
The thing is that the problem with all these, the two fields, the skeptics and the true believers, is that the most vocal, the people who shout the most are the people who get the most attention. You know?
This, true.
And to be fair with the skeptic camp, I know that they started to back away from people like Richard Dawkins and even from people like B.C. Myers a long time ago. So, I mean, whether, despite what we may be alluding in this episode, you know, B.C. is not as popular as he used to be, you know. People in the skeptic side, most of them take a much more reasonable attitude. I mean, it's not that they wouldn't have a problem with Laird or Peter Robbins. It's not that they are very skeptic and dismissive of the UFO phenomenon. It's not like maybe they're not really as have taken the trouble of really informing themselves or educating themselves to try to realize that despite what they read in skeptic-minded literature, there is something to the UFO phenomenon. There is something to these correlations that Laird has managed to found with the Dogon language and other ancient language and all this ancient knowledge that he's trying to investigate. But we never hear about these more reasonable or more neutral skeptics because they leave all the shouting to people like PC, just the same as people in the UFO field. They leave all the, you know, bombasting claims to people like Stephen Bassett or people like Dr. Stephen Greer.
True. And the thing is, a lot of, like, for someone like PZ Myers, I would consider him a true believer.
Sure.
It's just, you know, anyone who thinks they're right is a true believer. Like, who is absolutely convinced that their view of reality is the only correct one, they are a true believer. Whether it be that they believe in extraterrestrials or believe that there can't possibly be extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the skeptics are really the ones in the middle who are willing to listen, consider, and question.
Yep.
And questioning your own belief system is a hard thing for some people. I mean, it's hard for everyone to a degree, but you can train yourself to do it, to keep questioning things and never completely settle on something where it becomes a belief, a core belief that you can't shake and you base everything around.
What was this technique that Robert Anton Wilson developed? I don't remember. This kind of like, instead of never using direct verbs with regards to, like, saying UFOs are alien craft, you will say instead UFOs appear to be alien craft. I don't remember how. Greg Bishop is going to kill me because I don't remember this.
But right there, that makes sense. I mean, because you can say UFOs appear to be alien craft. Sure, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, even if we don't believe they're extraterrestrial, I mean, I don't believe that is the most likely explanation. I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I don't think it's likely. But yes, they definitely appear like they're alien craft.
Well, it reminds me of one of those things that I always applaud Mike Clellan for doing, which is he always says, so-and-so and so-and-so seems to be
yeah,
sure. XYZ. Yeah.
And that's one of the things Kripal focuses in on, too. And there's a difference between what is and what you perceive.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about one of the things he talks about in the new book about what he liked about Whitley Strieber's writing is that Strieber pretty much presented these as this is what I experienced. You know, he never set out and said, this is what happened and this was the explanation. It was always, this was the experience I had. And that's what I've always tried to do with my experiences because I don't know for sure what's behind any of them. So it's always, this is what I experienced. I can make guesses.
Yes, it reminds me of the things that we discussed when we were talking about this documentary about the nightmare. You know, the people who were interviewed in that documentary, they tried to narrate their personal experiences as best they could, you know, and that's as much as they could as you could ask for them, and you know,
yeah.
You can take about that what you will. You know, the only thing that you cannot do is to say that these people are attention seekers, are being dishonest. I mean, you could say, well, maybe they were completely wrong about what they experienced, but to say that they are all liars and that they're all hoaxers, that is crossing a line that only people like fundamental skeptics and fundamental believers like to do, and we should be mindful not to cross those lines.
So, gentlemen, to sort of switch tacks here a little bit, why do people like PZ feel the need to do this? Without falling back on the tried and true answer that it's because it threatens their livelihood or it threatens what they stand for, I feel like there's something deeper involved in the sort of knee-jerk reaction amongst a lot of debunkers. What is that?
Let me propose this one alternative idea. Josh, you being much more involved with academic life and life inside universities and seeing how we are now living in a overly conscious, politically correct kind of society. And some people have said that this obsession with political correctness is the result of the fact that there are no longer the great social battles to be fought. You know what I mean? Like gender equality, the struggle against racism in the 1960s. So people in this generation are left with the same level of, with the same passion, with the same level of, you know, being against the system, but now they have to fight with for the most trivial and inane issues like, oh my God, you know, you shouldn't appropriate that person's culture, you know, if you're using dreadlocks,
right.
Or if you're not from Jamaica, then you're appropriating a culture that is not wrong, something like that, you know. So maybe that's the reason why people like PC, you know, get so obsessed with these things that, you know, even people like Greg Bishop will say, you know, I mean, this is not really that important. The UFO phenomenon, yeah, we like it, but this is not really that important.
I think it could be important for our understanding of reality.
Sure.
So I think in that respect, it is important. But whether or not you believe Betty and Barney Hill saw aliens, you know, extraterrestrials came down and took them. I don't know. I guess if extraterrestrials really were taking people, that would be kind of an important issue.
Yeah, but go ahead, please, Josh.
I actually don't even know what I was going to say. I was just going to say, yeah,
sorry.
But... Da, da, da,
sorry.
Da.
At the same
if there was literally extraterrestrials here and they were kidnapping people and doing experiments on them, as some UFO researchers believe, I think that would be an important issue. But I also think it's important with the way I look at it, because it tells us so much about the reality we inhabit and what we don't know about it.
One of the other reasons why people like PC may, you know, go so hard against these alternative ideas is akin to what we also discussed on a previous show with regards to that other hit piece that was written against people who believed in the
electric universe.
Exactly. And the conclusion that this journalist reached, that if you believe in the alternative, in the electric universe, then you are dangerous because you may also believe in things like, I don't know, the anti-Semitism and, you know, the secret government, conspiracies, you know, and the 9/11 truth movement, the anti-vaccine movement, chemtrails and all of that. If we leave all these dangerous ideas unchecked, it's going to bring our world to the, you know, to the edge of catastrophe, something like that.
I think that people like PZ Myers need to believe that we understand this stuff. I think a lot of people like that, they've never had weird experiences, so when someone tells them of these weird experiences that are so far outside of their experience of the world, they just have to assume that these things are they're lying or they're just mistaken, because shouldn't it happen to everyone the same way?
And you know what? I completely disagree with that idea. I think that everybody has experienced something weird at least once in your lifetime. It's just that some people are better at trying to forget it, or trying to find a much more comforting explanation that doesn't really threaten their particular belief system.
That might be true. You make a good point there. They just write it off as something they can explain. Because I've met people who have said nothing weird's ever happened to me. But yeah, you know, if you push them, sometimes they'll be like, well, there was this one thing, but it was probably nothing. And maybe it was nothing. Who knows?
Yeah, the same thing happened to Micah, our friend Micah Hanks, the first time that he talked to Mike Leland. Mike, one of the first questions that Mike posed to Micah has anything weird happened to you? And Micah was like, no, not really, nothing, you know. What about synchronicities? Oh yeah, plenty of those. And Micah said, wait a minute, so what makes you think that synchronicities are not like weird or something that is almost as unexplainable as, you know, seeing a UFO in the middle of the sky?
True, and most people have had some experience with synchronicities, even if they don't acknowledge it as meaning anything.
Exactly.
And sometimes I wonder, in regards to people like PZ, perhaps they have their mind made up about what the world is like, what reality is like. And it's not so much that it's a professional thing, because that's what you always see people falling back on. Oh, they professionally don't want to admit that there's some sort of wiggle room for these sort of phenomena. But perhaps it's quite a personal thing. Like, I've made up my mind that this is the way that the world works, and I have no reason to think that I should act that there is anything beyond this material world. And it kind of frightens them in a way that there might be some sort of a gap in their knowledge in terms of what reality really is.
Yeah, I could see that. I think that's accurate. I mean, when we really think about it, though, I mean, we know so little about what we actually know. I mean, we're picking up things through our senses. We have imperfect memories. We all have different life experiences, so we all allow different things possible. Plus, we've all been taught different things. It's amazing that we come to any kind of consensus at all.
Yeah.
Right.
And what else is out there that we just don't even, that we just plain out ignore still? Maybe this stuff, maybe this weird stuff is just a gateway to something so much weirder that our brains just go, nope.
It's the proverbial tip of the iceberg.
Exactly. And if any day we were able to wrap our brains around this seemingly paranormal stuff, suddenly a whole new world would open up of what the hell is this? And look how little we knew. I mean, even when you get the people who are flat earthers, I mean, you know, we immediately dismiss the idea that we live on a flat earth. And I don't think the earth is flat. But even that information is only coming to us through certain gatekeepers, you know?
You know, just what you just said, you know, made me think of B.C. Myers as Dr. Seuss. At the end of the Planet of the Earth, the Planet of the Apes, you know, when that, you know, little chimp said, Dr. Seuss, what you just did, you know, the world, you know, I just saved it for you.
What did he go to find? His destiny.
Oh,
that's
all
what
right.
Z stands for. It stands for Zeus.
Dr. PC, Dr. PC. Oh, Dr. PC.
So, any last thoughts on this?
Well, that at last the paradigm symposium is over. Hopefully, other events will manage to pick up the mantle, or, you know, pick up where Paradigm left. I truly believe that there should be more events in which people of different belief systems, people of different level of skepticism should try to get together and share their point of views, their ideas, and also, very importantly, their personal experience without the fear of being judged or being ridiculed, because only good things would come up of all of that. I know I speak from a personal experience. You know, going to Paradigm Symposium in 2012 was truly one of the best things that I have ever done in my life. And it was, like I said, it was a turning point, and only for the best, you know. And that's the kind of thing that I wished for every single person that is listening to this podcast right now.
And I think, too, that when we talk to people who have different viewpoints, that's how we expand our own.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're open-minded enough to actually listen and consider.
Mm-hmm.
Josh?
Yeah, that would be my takeaway as well. I mean, just try to be... Whenever you enter into a culture, because that's what we are as a paranormal group, we're a culture, try to familiarize yourself. Try to give people the benefit of the doubt. But... more than anything else, try to see things the way that other people might see them. Try to check your own belief system, and always try to approach these things with an open mind.
Yes, always question your own BS.
Exactly.
Sucks.
Belief system.
Yep.
Yep.
And we will do a show on Robert Anton Wilson sometime soon. I know people have asked about that as well. And I should say that Joshua, Mike, and I will be at Fort Fest 2016.
Yes, June 11th.
Well, 12th.
Well, yeah, the whole event starts 11th and 12th. But yeah, the 12th is when the three of us will be together. Our powers combine.
Now we just need red pill.
Oh, well, you know, guys. Have a blast at the Fort Fest and have a few beers on my health.
Me, no.
I don't drink. What am I supposed to do?
Well, think of something fun then.
I'll slap Josh around a little for you.
All that right. works. Always works.
But yes, if anyone's coming to that, let us know. FortFest 2016. I wrote 2012 and keep wanting to say 2012. I don't know why. 2012 is just what comes out of me at the moment.
Yeah, Michael Hughes, Soraya Azcath, and Joshua Cutchin all in one room.
Yeah.
And I don't know who else is going to be on Sunday.
I know that Rosemary Ellen Guiley is going to be on Saturday. So that's
Yeah, that's the only other person I know about for sure.
That's a big deal, so.
Hopefully she'll still be around on Sunday.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank both of you. This has been interesting.
You're very welcome. Pleasure as always.
Yeah, likewise.